You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Casey. Did you ever know anyone in school who did a great job and aced the exam, but flunked the term paper? Their final grade wasn't that great. Well, retirement's the same way. You can do a great job planning for the financial side, ace that, and end up having difficulty on the non-financial side by not preparing. Today, we have two special guests who are the co-authors of the new book, Retiring. Your next chapter is about much more than money. And they'll share their observations, insights, and personal experiences that can help you prepare better for the non-financial side of retirement. Ted Kaufman is the former U.S. Senator from Delaware, succeeding Senator Joseph Biden. Ted was Biden's chief of staff for 19 years and led his presidential transition planning in 2020. He taught at Duke Law School for 26 years. At 81, he and his wife, Lynn, celebrate their 61st anniversary this year. Bruce Hyland's career included McKinsey, more than 4 years as chief administrative officer at Time Inc., 20 years of independent consulting, and 4 startups. Now 80, he and Jenny, married 57 years, are enjoying their family, dealing with aging, and harvesting the fruits of their labor. Their full bios are in our show notes, and I encourage you to take a look. They have fascinating and very interesting careers and lives that you can get a sense of. Ted and Bruce, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Great to be here, Joe. Thanks for having us.
So our listeners have just heard your bios, and I'm sure they'd really love to hear the stories of your retirements.
Our definition of retirement is, which is a new definition, is when you have control of your own schedule, when you're not at the being controlled by somebody else. And you can really kind of retire a number of times, retire, then go back under control, and then go out of it. And I'm recidivist. I've retired a number of times. The first time I retired was in 1995. I was Joe Biden's chief of staff in the Senate, and just it was time for me to get out and retire. And I was still working 60 hours a week, but I was controlling the key thing. I was controlling my own schedule. That lasted for a number of years until 2008, when Joe Biden got picked and was elected vice president of the United States. And the governor of our state, Ruth Ann Minner, asked me to replace him in the Senate and finish his term, which I did, but was clearly not a retirement job. And then in 2010, I returned to retirement, and I lasted for 10 years. And then, again, Joe Biden, he was a presidential candidate. This is before he was actually picked, but you have to start on this. He asked me to head up his presidential transition. And I did that for about 8-9 months until January 20th of 2021, when he was inaugurated and I returned to retirement. And I have made a pledge. I am here in retirement to stay. Bruce?
We'll see. My story was like Ted, I'm a recidivist. I've had 3 tries. I think I've got it this time. My first shot was I was 52 years old. I'd been going flat out in New York for years. We bought an escape place in Vermont, a fun farm outside of Middlebury, Vermont. And through a combination of circumstances, we decided that, gee, we'd like to live in Vermont. So this was coincident with the time that my principal client, the chairman of the stock exchange, was retiring. We had a gentleman's agreement. I wouldn't retire before he did. He retired. So I decided I was going to move to Vermont. That lasted 6 months. I discovered in the 6 months that 2 things. One is that one of my real motivations was I needed to do something that had tangible work, where there was an end product at the end of the day. And the other thing I discovered was that I just needed a sabbatical. So that when the next chairman of the stock exchange called and said, quote, drop the rocks and get down here. I was back in New York. I kept at it with the exchange and with their tech subsidiaries until the end of 2002. I was then 63. I decided that after the adventures of 2001 and the fact that I was actually nearing retirement and that my 90-year-old parents had just decided to relocate from Florida back to Vermont because my mother said she wasn't going to die in a flat place. So we had new responsibilities in Vermont. But the funny part about that was that I gave up all the New York activities of my consulting practice. But along the way, I'd gotten very involved in community activities here in Vermont, startups, a whole bunch of things. And so all I did was change venue. I failed Ted's test of having control of my schedule. There were all these other demands. That lasted for 16 years. And when I was 79, that's 3 years ago, I sold the property in Middlebury that was the anchor, historical anchor, got out of all the community activities and the like. And now I'm retired. It was one little wrinkle because my partner, lifelong friend and co-author, had taken this other gig for the highest office of the United States and in the midst of our book writing. So I had a couple of intense months learning how to write a book that Ted and I had been constructing and organizing and doing everything for until he had to go do what he did. That was an easy call. His work took priority. So anyway, I think I'm retired today.
There's a great story in your book, too, about what it was like to come from New York. I worked there 30 years as well. And to Vermont, what was some of the feedback you got from the Vermonters?
The feedback from the way Vermont works, we were in a town of under 1,500 people outside of a college town, very much rural, agrarian Vermont. And the enormous advantage we had was that when we bought this house, we knew we wanted to do a lot of work on it. We put together a great crew, and they worked alongside of us in the house. Now, these were all people that were well-connected in the community. And what happened was that we got along well with them. They got along well with us. So the word got out in the community, the people from New York, they're okay. So that was an opening to all sorts of things. I got drafted to take over the school board. That's another story. But the transition, the cultural adjustment from New York, living in New York, and then moving into this small village was fascinating. It was never stressful. It was more often humorous than it was disruptive. And I vividly recall when I was flying back and forth from Burlington to New York City when I was still going back, I'd get off the plane on Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock and I'm in full battle dress, get in the car and I'd start down Route 116. And I knew when I got to North Ferrisburg that I was going to have to stop because that was coincident with the time when the dairy farmer brought his herd from the field up to the barn for milking. And I'd stop. I'd take my tie off, my jacket's in the back seat, and honest to goodness, in about 15 minutes, the cultural adjustment was over. It's been wonderful. We love it here.
That's great. So I read that you noticed some unhappiness among friends and acquaintances who were retiring that really led you to collaborate on this book. What did you notice? What was behind your friends' unhappiness?
Simply put, and Ted and I sorted this out over endless cups of coffee in a little Burger King in Florida over the years. It was their failure to plan. That was a synthesis of all the anecdotes. Every single one of these people in our acquaintanceship and the stories secondhand stories we heard, none of them had financial distress. They all had varying degrees. I mean, some were filthy rich and some were just very comfortable. They'd all figured out how to take care of the financial side, but none of them had figured out what to do with the rest of their life. What am I going to do when I'm not what I used to be? And that manifested itself in lots of different ways, but it was a general discontent. Sometimes it was you could sense problems in marital relationships that had been stable for a long time. You could sense guys that were, and this admittedly men, sense guys that were kind of looking for something to do in a, almost a physical sense, guys that were uncomfortable not being important anymore. Just a variety of symptoms, if you will, but they had missed the big question of what am I going to do after I retire? And as Ted pointed out early on, a lot of them were kind of work on the old assumption their parents, when their parents retired, you know, you retired, you played golf for 5 or 6 years and kind of disappeared. That's when life expectancies were very different, health was very different and the like. But that unhappiness was, it was varied, but it was widespread. And finally, it came to the two of us in our discussions that this was because they had the financial stuff in hand, but nobody had spent, they didn't even ask the right questions, which is why our book is structured the way it is. So that's about it.
I think they also just hadn't figured out how complex this was going to be.
So a lot of people listening aren't retired yet. What do people who haven't retired yet need to know about how different retirement is today?
Yeah, I think Bruce mentioned it in discussing why we got started. I mean, it was pretty clear pretty quickly that most of the people our age, and Bruce and I are both 82, when our parents had retired, first off, most of our parents worked for a big organization, the U.S. government, state government. They worked for a big company. They worked for a big hospital. They worked for a big thing. And essentially, one of the shocks to us when we actually started looking at the numbers, I mean, the average folks today stay in a job is 3 or 4 years. And Bruce and I stayed in jobs for like, everybody stayed in jobs for 10, 15, 20 years. They just thought that they were going to do the same thing their parents did. That was going to be too long. Basically, what used to happen was people would get Social Security, they'd get a pension, and they'd be 65 years old, and they'd work for, you know, 5, 7, 10 years, and then they would pass. Well, when you look at the numbers today on what's happening, using our definition of retirement, which is really an excellent, we didn't make this up. By the way, none of these things in this book Bruce and I made up. These are all based on talking to just many, 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 many retirees. And we've been working on this for almost 6 years. And the first 2 or 3 years, we never even thought about a book. We were just making a conversation at a Burger King, as Bruce said earlier. But what is it? So they think that, well, if you're retiring in your 50s, your life expectancy is in your 90s. There's a big difference from planning for 5 to 10 years and planning for 30 years. You've got to have a plan. And one of the things that kind of, whenever you do a project, there's kind of one thing that happens that kind of really catalyzes or exactly what you're thinking about. And Bruce and I, at the same time, New York Times, there was a letter to the editor in New York Times. And the writer said, in the middle of a thing, he was saying, his retirement plan. His retirement plan was walks in the park, spending time with his grandkids, and reading. Now, you can do that for 2 or 3 or 4 years. You know what I mean? You can't do that for 30 or 40 years. And that's what happened. I think just more and more, like we have good friends that retired and was going to play golf. Well, after 5 or 10 years, the shoulder went, the knee went, the hip went. They just found it. You know, there's more to life than playing golf every day. And so what do we do now? I'm 80 years old. I got another 10 years in my life. And the basic thing, going to the club and playing golf or, you know, going bowling or whatever else, whatever the thing was, I'm going to hike, I'm going to kayak, whatever else. Those things are all gone. And you got 10 more years. So that I think that's really the main thing, the main problem that we found that faces retirees today based on what they've faced in the past. And again, it's based on us talking to retirees, not something, you know, we're sitting around philosophizing about.
So part of it is not realizing the longevity change. What else gets in the way of people planning well for the non-financial side of retirement?
I backed off from my earlier thinking about this and just looked at all the things that we've seen and heard and obviously what we've written about. And the first went to the top of the list was interesting, and that is the noise about financial planning. There is so much money spent by, we know all the organizations, telling people they're planning for retirement. It sweeps across every socioeconomic level. It's in every media. It's just a noise. My hypothesis is that that confuses people when they put retirement and planning together. That's the only thing they're aware of. Now, that would be the top of the list. The second one, and a friend of mine who I've worked with for, I guess, 15 years now, who runs a high-end wealth management office, he sent me an email two or three years ago, and he said, I'm just telling you, this book you're talking about, the title for the book should be Overcoming Denial. Oh, tell me more. And he did. They work comprehensively with clients, basically, I think it's called a family office these days. And here they are working on all these financial issues, very, very complex situations. And Ted told me that at least half of the time, they were unable to get their clients to talk about anything other than these financial, factual things. Getting them to think about what they do when they weren't CEO or whatever title they carried, just didn't go there. The conversation was shut down. They'd move right on. They'd change the subject. They'd say, "Don't, I'm not going to talk about that." So denial is not a trivial factor. My hunch is that denial is more common with people who have been totally consumed by their work, where they've just been obsessed with what they were doing. The next one on the list is they're too busy. We ran into this. I think this tends to go with professionals who are doing what they're doing right up until the day they're going to retire. We'll talk about when in a minute, but it's like, well, they're too busy. They've got client work to do. They've got stuff to do. So as far as doing any thinking, serious, heavy-duty thinking about the rest of their life, too busy. Then the next one was the bucket list fantasy. And Ted and I had some funny anecdotes along the way of people that, talking about people that haven't retired yet. And what are you going to do when you retire? Well, I've got my bucket list, you know, and they boom, tick, 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 tick down there. You know, you'd listen to them. At first, you just kind of listen to them. And then as time went on, you'd listen to them start to grin because it would add up to maybe a year and a half, to maybe 3 or 4 years, and it tended to be travel and big adventures and all that stuff. So, yeah, what do you do when you come home from the trip? Okay, you get through the bucket list, then what? Plus, a lot of the stuff that they had on their bucket list, a recollection of mine, was a lot of the stuff on the bucket list was once you get up to thinking about doing it, you're not going to care about that. So it's kind of artificial. And then the last one on my list of stuff that gets in the way, and for people that are fortunate enough to have a partner, in any case, it's essential that you communicate with your partner about what your life plans are. I mean, that's just kind of basic 101. But in the case of retirement, it gets particularly interesting because we've all heard the cliche about for better, for worse, but not for lunch. And the husband, you know, you're in trouble when the husband's rearranging the spice shelf. But the other dimension of this that was fascinating was the partnerships in which both of them had positions and they were slightly different ages. And I got properly upbraided by a neighbor academic a couple of years ago when she was reading an early draft. And first off, she was pointing out that this was through the eyes of two old white guys, which was true, but such it is. The other part of it was that her husband had kind of offhandedly announced at breakfast not more than 2 weeks before that a plan, and he'd be retiring in 2 years, and he thought they should do this, 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 and this. The first time the subject had ever come up, and he's got his little plan he's dreamt up. That conversation didn't go well that day. I happened to be 2 weeks later in the line of fire. I never heard from her again, but I know that the conversation must have continued. So that the failure to communicate, the old cliche from that Paul Newman movie, the failure to communicate can really just absolutely prevent any meaningful planning.
Ted, how about you? What do you think gets in the way?
Oh, I think Bruce has said it, made an excellent list. I mean, it's amazing how many times when you talk to retirees, it keeps coming back to the same thing. And I think a lot of it also is they're in a job they like the job, but it's stressful and they're doing things that they don't want to do. And they've got a boss that they know more than the boss does. And you know, that'll pass up. So they're basically thinking about, it would be great to get out in the hammock in the back of my house and sit in the, lie in the hammock and read a book. I really think it's that kind of where they're just, again, talking to a lot of them and talking to people beforehand. Like, you know, now that we're writing a book on retirement, it comes up and people say, you know, whoa, you know, I'm not retiring. This is what I'm going to do. I had a discussion with a head of a major hospital, and it was at a cocktail party, and he'd been retired for about 6 months. And we were talking, and he was complaining about retirement. I said to him, well, and this was like 10 years ago. So this is before even thinking about the book, even before we started talking about it. I said to him, well, you know, have you sat down and made a plan? You know, do you have a strategy on how you're going to influence it? Oh, I work with strategy every day. You know, when I was, I did this, didn't they want to much? And it was, I came this close to saying, well, if you knew about strategy and planning, why the hell didn't you do it for your retirement? And it was like, there's no connect. So anyway, I think Bruce got the at the heart of it. And I think the other one is that people think it's going to be a walk in the park. And I think they're thinking 5 or 6 years, and it turns out to be 30 years, and it's sad.
Appreciate your point on denial. And that's what I see in the work I do. People have a view, how hard could it be? I've solved all these really complicated things in my career. This sounds like something I could put off, do later, and it'll be a breeze. But we also get older as we retire, and all kinds of other things tend to come into the equation as well. So my next question is something I know is in your wheelhouse because you are experienced at multiple retirements. So I know you have a point of view on this. And that's, when does someone know when to retire?
Ted just alluded to indicators that can pop up. And I look back through the book this morning, and I tried to remember how many items. We said set up a whole bunch of questions. These are indicators that people can think about. You feel the stress level of your job is excessive, and then you can agree or disagree. This is questionnaire format. So you're concerned about your health. That's not a trivial issue for everybody. You're no longer finding satisfaction in your work. Aspects of your job you always found exciting now bore you. You're fed up with interpersonal and administrative problems. You're tired of working for someone else. You want to control your schedule. You want a much more flexible work schedule. You have specific things you want to do while you're physically and mentally able. You have an opportunity to do something completely different, an offer to teach, like Ted had when he went off to Duke, to join a colleague in a joint venture, which I did, to write a book, which, my gosh, that sounds familiar. We were retired by the time we did that. And then you want to spend more and better time with family and good friends. That one, unfortunately, if I were rewriting it, I'd try and get the phrasing a little bit better. That's, I've heard too many excuses. It's like when the guy gets fired as chief executive officer, and his response is he wants to spend more time with his family and friends. It's a really legitimate concern for a lot of the people that I've worked with who are, they had always had good relationships with their family despite the stresses of their jobs. And they finally were getting to the point where they're looking ahead and saying, I don't have enough time to do all the things I want to do. And I've got grandkids that are just, you know, they're fascinating. And that's the gist of the message there. The other things about when to retire, people have employers who have policies. Policies, that's the latest you can retire. But the other part of that is you can retire before the policy if you want to. A good friend of mine up here was a senior financial guy for a big company. And he was somehow got in a conversation with a friend of his that had just retired. And Nick was, I think he was 53 at the time. And the guy said to him, so what are you planning for retirement? Nick said, what do you mean? I'm 53, on top of my game. What are you talking about? And the guy says, retire early. Otherwise, you miss the best 5 years of your retirement. And he did, and it worked that way. So the deciding when, yep, there are a lot of moving parts, but it's an essential element that when do I retire? What am I going to do? Where are we going to live? Are the three legs of the stool. And then the list of what you do after you start to answer those, it comes to follow.
Anything to add to it?
No, I think that's right on point.
So You mentioned before that one of the challenges some people have is not feeling important anymore. They had a title, they had a big role, et cetera. So the challenge is people's identity can shift, particularly those who were, as you mentioned, really associated with their work, really into their work. What have your experiences in retirement taught you about identity?
This is an absolute, incredibly recurring theme when you talk to retirees about the shock, the bad surprises. My old boss used to say, a job is about a lot more than money. It's who you are. And man, that is absolutely true. That is so true for so many people. And we talked to many, many, many retirees. And the loss of the identity of their job is a major problem. It's like a pandemic in the modern retirement. We spent a lot of time in the book talking about that. And when they retired, they found out they lost many of their social relationships that came with their job, which they didn't think about. They knew they weren't going to go into work, but they thought they'd still be friends. And the biggest example, and Bruce, how many times? I mean, this is innumerable times where you talk to somebody and a friend, and a big problem is going to lunch. You know, when you're in a job, most of us, no matter what our job is, we go to lunch with the people you're working with. And you go out, and what do you talk about? You may talk about a little bit of sports, you may talk about this. Most of the time, you're talking about what's going on in the organization that you're in. What's going on, what's right, what's wrong, and everything else. And the sad thing is that we heard from so many people, after they left the job, they'd get together for lunch, and the first one would be okay, and they'd talk about the job, and they'd talk about the second one. But by the third one, they didn't have anything to talk about anymore. And that's kind of the poster child for this whole overall problem of not of your where social position and who you are. I mean, there's loads of people, they wouldn't go out and do volunteer jobs because how would it look to the people back on the job if I was doing a volunteer job? In the book, we talk about one of the best examples I have is there's a man in this case who was a big, high up in the DuPont lawyer. And he was interested in wine. So he retired and really did what I thought was an incredibly smart thing. He went down to the local wine distributor and he said, I want to sell wine. The wine store said, well, we got all the people. He said, I'll do it for nothing. And he was there and people won't do it because they're worried when somebody walks in and sees someone like that selling wine, it's like, what could happen to poor Harry? So I think that's that whole social standing thing is a key element in why people are very unhappy about their job, about their retirement.
So one of the many things I liked about your book is it does a great job capturing how multidimensional retirement is. And you have to prepare for that, keeping that at the top of mind. And one of the things that stood out to me in your book was the chapter, Maintaining Your Soul. What's the importance of spirituality and purpose in retirement in your experiences?
Yeah, and by the way, we're not talking about spirituality being totally a formal, religious kind of inclined. But when you start doing the research, you find out that spirituality can have a major physical benefit in retirement. And let me just read you. I got a bunch of quotes here, and there's a bunch of quotes in the book. Let me just read you two of them. An Oxford University study summed it up best. Spirituality is an integral dimension of human beings and been recognized as, listen to this, a critical factor in the health and well-being of patients. Another one says, in Cancer, which is the magazine of the Journal of American Cancer Society, they suggest a link between religious or spiritual beliefs and better physical health reported among patients with cancer. And there's all kinds of them. There's all kinds of numbers to support what these folks are saying. They did a study, professors from Columbia University and New York State Psychiatric Institute. They researchers did a study and they found a direct correlation. Listen to this, a direct correlation between the importance of spirituality in a person's life and the thickness of the cerebral cortex, the part of the brain responsible for sensory perception, language, and emotion process. There's a study that we talk about in the book. I think Bruce is right, 7%. The Harvard did a study and found that you get 7% better off in terms of physical and emotional well-being among people who are spiritual. This is just to use our old business thing. This is a cost-benefit relationship. You know, this is really something that can have a major effect on the emotional and physical health while you're going through retirement. And I would say, based on my experience, and again, watching what other seniors have done, it really is a major factor.
Interestingly, I'd add one other thing to that. I'm trying to recall the source of the research, but there was a research study that pointed out that people somewhere around 60 is when they start reflecting upon meaning. And that's what it boils down to. I mean, why am I here? 2 o'clock in the morning, what have I done? What's my role and life and the greater system? And the idea that there's something evidently hardwired into us that about 60, when you're getting close to this retirement zone, that your body's telling you, your brain's telling you something like, pay attention to this. It's important.
I really think that when you get to be 80, the people I talk to, and the reason I feel comfortable with what we do with our lives. So it's kind of comes, oh, man, there are a lot of folks that aren't.
That aren't, yeah.
So, I mean, that's another, we haven't mentioned that in the thing, but, and it's a spiritual, you know, it's kind of spiritual. Bruce has made the point. I mean, you know, if I could get everybody in the world in a room, young people, I'd say, you know, the money's important and money really works. But when you get to my age, if you really want to feel good about yourself, think about public service.
So you also portray in the book retirement as an ongoing learning experience, and both of you are continuing to pick up new things along the way. And I'll ask each of you, Ted, could you share with us how you bookend your days?
Yeah, no, and I've been doing it now for quite a while. And basically, I'm a Catholic. So every morning I go to daily mass. Just about every morning I go to daily mass. It's half an hour. And I'll tell you, in today's chaotic kind of dog-eat-dog world, politically, economically, and every other way, it's kind of nice to sit down someplace with a bunch of people and somebody say, do unto others as others would do unto you, and nobody laughs. Do you know what I mean? It's, and there's so many of that. It's just, it's a nice way to start the day. And then the end of the day is I spend just about every day an hour working out, walking. I'm a little bummed up, so I can't do my elliptical right now because of an ankle. But walking, I can still do that. I can do biking. I can do all those other things. So you got it right. For me, it's kind of a bookend. And when I'm planning my days, like a week from now, a month from now, I got the two ends. And then and the beauty about them is the first one, you really can't move around depending on where you live and where the local church is. But it doesn't have to be a church thing. It's just kind of a starting out thinking about the world and what it means, the rest of it. And then at the end of the day, that's the one that slips and slides based on what I've done during the day.
Appreciate that. Very helpful. And Bruce, could you tell us about the Winners Walk Tall program that you've been involved with?
That's a remarkable experience. When I'm in Vero Beach in the winter, a friend approached me just as a, hey, we need some people to do this, and said it's Winners Walk Tall. I said, I've never heard of it. What does it do? Long and the short of it, Winners Walk Tall puts people like me in front of fourth and fifth graders in underprivileged schools with the idea of just conveying basic cultural norms, standards, convention. I'm a social major, so I say things like it's an acculturation process. These are kids that they aren't getting it at other places, or they're getting it a little bit at home, but it's getting offset by what else they experience. And when I talk about kids that are underprivileged, lacking privilege, the most vivid example I can use for proof of that is that in the Vero Beach Elementary School where I work, I had kids in fourth and fifth grade who live within probably 4 to 5 miles of the school. The school is set back about 2 miles from the Indian River Lagoon. Across the lagoon is the barrier island where all this wealthy people winter. And then there's the Atlantic Ocean. I had one class where an astounding number of the kids had never seen the ocean. Now, that's just like, it was one of those things that had a very hard time processing that because families go to the beach, kids go to the beach, school trips go to the beach, but these are fourth and fifth grade. They'd never seen the ocean. It was no fault of their own. Any case, the Winners Walk Tall program was real fulfillment for me because my job was to walk in and see all these faces and have a particular thing that we talk about that day. I talked for probably 20 minutes max, and as time went on, I talked less and they talked more. and we'd have a subject. It would be like cheating or bullying or anything like that. Started off, though, with, and I can't remember if this was part of the program or something that I did on my own. One of the things I did was I went around and taught each of the kids how to shake hands and make eye contact and say their name by way of an introduction. The impact of that was extraordinary over a couple of or a semester. There was a young girl who sat two rows from me in the first class I went into, who for the first several weeks kept her head down. She would not look up. She wore a sweater, and she put her hands inside the arm of each sweater. So she was, it was the ultimate protective mode. And finally, in the fourth week, I got her to shake my hand, and then she made eye contact. It's amazing. The other thing that Winner's Walk Tall does is it, I was going to say it's a wake-up call, and that's an oversimplification. It was a profound reminder of the importance of that kind of education, along with the schoolwork. The teachers that I worked with were remarkable. They welcomed this with open arms because as these kids learned these basic cultural devices about how to communicate respectfully with each other and how to participate in a class discussion without putting down somebody or without interrupting them, it made their job much easier. It was a meaningful present to me because I walked into this thing just kind of, sure, I'll help out. Can't be against working with little kids. And it did more for me than it did for them.
Thanks for sharing that, both of you. Great stories. So final question, if I could, what's one key message that you each want people to take away about retirement?
Yeah, I think the main message that I would say is start. You don't have to start retirement planning in detail or things like that, but just start thinking about in more detail what it is what you want to do in retirement and keep your eyes open. The best example that I had was in 1990 on one of the Supreme Court nominations. Professor at Duke, Chris Schrader, was working on it. And he came to me and said, in 1991, I'd like, will you come down to Duke like once a week and teach a course with me about Washington and the Congress and things like that? I said, God, Chris, I'd love to, but I'm working for senior senator. I don't have time. And he said, well, just think about it. So I went home and I talked to Lynn, my wife, and she said, you know, you can make this work. I mean, that would be a great thing for you to do when you retire. And it was the first time I'd ever, I think, used the word retire. And so I went back and I talked to then Senator Biden. And I said, look, it's going to be on Monday. I'm going to fly down to Durham. I'm going to teach the course. I'm going to fly back. And I think I can. He was really enthusiastic about it. He said, that'd be a great thing. And I did it. Now, I ended up after retirement teaching at Duke in the law school, the business school, and the public policy school one time or another for 21 years. So if you're looking at a 30-year retirement and you know that for 21 years, you're going to be teaching at a university, we have a term in the book that Bruce used earlier. What is your anchor store? What is the thing that's part of the same thing? What is your anchor store? If somebody comes up and says, if you're building a mall, you build the one big store. You got to get the Macy's, you got to get the Nordstrom's, you got to get one of those stores, and then you build the little things around it. So our thing is, when you start thinking about retirement, think about an anchor store. And it's the real simple way to explain it is, if somebody walks up to your street and you're retired and they say, what are you doing? You can tell them your anchor store. For 21 years, rather than get, and 21 years, they say, what's your anchor store? And I said, well, except maybe for some campaigns, it was teaching at Duke University. And I made a suggestion to a friend myself, but it's like 2 or 3 or 4 years. Let's just say you're real an expert. I mean, I know a lot of people that are experts in a lot of things. They want to teach at a university, but they go down to the university. Well, we've got somebody teaching tort law. And so if you get in there 2 or 3 years from now, we can work it out so you can teach a course on tort law. But if it isn't something you walk into and 6 months later, you're in the job. So that's the thing I've learned.
My advice is get the financial planning done. Buy our book, read the book, get to work on what it says in the book. And it's everybody that we hear from. I got an email yesterday from a guy who's a serial entrepreneur here in Vermont. He said, I finally finished your book on the 100th day of my practice retirement. That was the way he described it. And he said, oh my God, this is helpful. I'm giving it to all my friends and relatives this year. Ted got an email from a Maureen Dowd, who did a column a couple of weeks ago, and Ted got mentioned in it as Joe's best friend. And Maureen, she said, I'm giving one to everybody in the family. And we're in this funny position because here we did this, you know, we took on this hobby project of writing a book. We said at the outset, this is purely to help other people, and any money we make is going to charities. So at the time, I think we thought this would be kind of, you know, a little book and little, well, it's getting to be a little bit more complicated than that. But the message we're getting back from the people that get the book and read it is incredibly reinforcing. I was sitting at my desk a month ago, scratching. Okay, suppose this was really a business and we had to come up with an ad. So my ad is just a picture of the cover of the book that says, this is the best $17.95 you can spend on your planning for retirement. And I really believe that these days because all the financial stuff, the financial planning, it happens that people can't get away from it. But all the rest of this stuff, as we say, your next chapter is about much more than money.
Yeah, Bruce identified real early a point that I had not thought about is turning out to be true when we started talking to more and more people unhappy, that the people that are going to be buying this book are not going to be the people we're talking to are unhappy. It's going to be their wives or husbands or sisters or brothers or that's where it's been. I mean, what Maureen Dowd said to me, we get over and over and over again. I'm going to send this out because so many of these people are unhappy. They're what we call failing retirement, and it's like throwing a life preserver.
One of my favorite clients came from a woman who listens to the podcast, called me one day and said, my husband needs you. He just doesn't know it yet.
We're all
on the same page.
Exactly.
Well, I appreciate everything you're doing to bring attention to this critical issue. It really does give people practical, tangible advice, a lot of tools in the book, a lot of questionnaires to guide your reflection, and a lot of wisdom and action. So can't say enough about the book and appreciate both of you taking the time to share it with us today.
Hey, thanks for having us,
Joe. Thank you.
It's been great.
I appreciate Ted Kaufman and Bruce Hyland making the time to share their experiences, their wisdom, and insights with us. They brought up a number of things that I see day in and day out in the work I do with clients as a coach. And I'd like to underscore a couple of the points they made. There were many valuable points, and the book is a great resource. But a couple of things jumped out to me in listening to them. One is, what was driving the unhappiness they noticed in their friends and acquaintances who were retiring or thinking about retiring? And that there was an unhappiness there. What was it driven by? Failure to plan, specifically about the non-financial aspects, not just about the financial side. That's critical. But what are you going to do? How are you going to invest your time? Number two, what prevents people from planning as well for the non-financial side as they do for the financial side? And the topic of denial was highlighted. Very important. You have to face up to, there are two sides to this. And I find that it takes a different mindset to plan for each side. Think about it. Financial planning is a left-brainy kind of activity. It takes right-brain types of things like moving into the qualitative space, moving into the imaginative space, strategy, forecasting, etc., and a lot of visioning. That's outside the comfort zone of many people who are really good at the financial side, which is all about logic, the numbers, things tick and tie, they're linear, etc., where this other side is nonlinear. But once people take even just one step out of their comfort zone and start exploring, it becomes very valuable. So be willing to step outside your comfort zone is what that triggered. That's the route out of denial. Third is identity. What happens with people who are tied to their work, think of themselves in terms of work, when that job is no longer part of their world? Well, it's an identity crisis, not a midlife crisis necessarily, but an identity one. Who are they now moving into their retirement? And what I see is that we're much more than our business cards, much more than our titles, much more than who we are based on what we do. And exploring that, can be very valuable. And as Ted Kaufman brought up, it can be a real shock to the system when people first encounter that, if they haven't anticipated, if they haven't thought it through, if they haven't talked to others who have gone through this already. And finally, keep top of mind the fact that this is really ultimately all about meaning. What's most important to you? What are the things that are going to give you meaning in the years ahead? And I loved their catchy phrase of, what's your anchor store? What's that anchor going to be for you? What's the thing that you're going to center your next phase around? There may be other things. Most of my clients use a portfolio approach. They're involved in many different things. But what's that central one? What's that one that you're going to keep coming back to? Very valuable concept. Great phrase. Their book is Retiring. Your next chapter is about much more than money. And the two authors are Ted Kaufman and Bruce Hyland. I read a ton of books on retirement, and I can tell you that this is a book that is very valuable because it's a few things. Number one, it's very succinct. Number two, it's very practical and useful. It's a guidebook, and it contains a ton of useful questions to reflect on, things to consider. It'll expand your thinking and give you a window into how multidimensional retirement really is and why it's wise to invest some time planning for it in this way. It's also a book, as they mentioned, where the proceeds are going to charity. And then finally, I think it's a book that you're going to give to many others in your life. People you know who may be thinking about retirement, people who are already in retirement. It's going to be one of those books that you will consider gifting to others. Thank you for listening to Retirement Wisdom Podcast. Our mission is to help people balance their planning for retirement by focusing more on the things that really make a difference, the non-financial aspects. Retirement can really often seem like an end, but if you step back and think about it a minute, it's really a beginning. It's a beginning of your next chapters. But the question is, where do you start? Our coaching process with a certified Designing Your Life coach, me, helps you build a new life that's based on what matters most to you, a new life that's on your own terms. We help you build a roadmap to your future, one that really is driven by those things that truly do matter most to you. So you can start here, Retirement Wisdom. Check out our website. You'll find a number of resources. We have a bunch of calculators that are free, retirement financial calculators, longevity calculators, and we have a very short 10-item quiz, which will give you a snapshot of how well prepared you are today against these non-financial factors. You'll also find all 99 episodes of our podcast to date. We have our 100th coming up shortly, and you can access them on our website, retirementwisdom.com. Thanks again for listening to Retirement Wisdom Podcast. If you have any suggestions, comments, please let us know. If you want to leave a rating for us on Apple Podcasts, that's always appreciated. Thanks again.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.